Let's get started on our second presentation on bonds, where we will go through the various types of bonds, the most important categories, and we're going to go from the least riskiest to the riskiest. So let's start on slide 25. Treasuries, governments, T-bonds, T-notes. Remember, there's a difference between 2 and 10 year treasury notes and 20 and 30 year treasury bonds. I don't care. They're treasuries. They're bonds. Now, the Treasury started issuing these TIPS, Treasury Inflation Indexed Obligations. The principal is adjusted each year by the inflation rate, because many people back in the 80s were just terrified of bonds because of inflation. And so they decided, the Treasury said, well, you know what, let's create these TIPS so that they'll pay interest, they'll pay less than regular bonds, but they'll be protected against inflation. And we'll see how that works in a future slide coming up. Now, the agency bonds, Ginny Mae, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, these are not technically direct obligations of the United States Treasury. They were sponsored by the Congress. However, they have an implicit guarantee. Because they were sponsored by the United States government, people, investors, tend to believe that, you know, they're like treasuries. They're not going to go under. And for decades, the Treasury said, we're not going to backstop these Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and Ginny Mae bonds. Remember, these are for-profit entities now that we sponsored, but we're no longer involved with them. Until the Great Recession, until their bonds went belly up. No, they didn't go belly up. They just became very, very distressed as the mortgage crisis, as the housing bubble burst and the housing crisis got deeper and deeper and deeper. So, yes, there was an implicit guarantee which became explicit. Oh, well. TIPS. As we said, we'll discuss TIPS in a bit here. They're a type of treasury security that provides protection against inflation by adjusting investor returns for the annual rate of inflation. So how does this work? Initially, they pay less interest than other treasuries, but the par value is adjusted upward each year to keep pace with inflation. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the interest payment goes up as the par value, as the face value, as the bond becomes worth more. However, you must pay taxes on the interest, well, you always have to pay taxes on the interest, and the increase in the par value, even though you did not receive the increase in par value as cash. The IRS says, well, you know, whatever, inflation went up to 2%, you got 2% on your loan, even though you didn't get it in cash, they require you to pay taxes on it. If you put it in a retirement account, then you don't have to worry about it, right? So these are very popular with people who are afraid of inflation. They don't pay much interest at all, to be truthful. But if you're worried that inflation is going to come back with a vengeance, these things would be really, really welcome in your portfolio. Slide 27, mortgage-backed bonds. Some of them were associated with the agencies, but they're not the only ones. These are debt securities issued by pools of home mortgages. Now, not only issued by the Fannie Mae's and the Freddie Mac's, a lot of people thought Fannie Mae was a candy company, but these were primarily issued by them. In fact, about 70% of the home loan funding comes from these entities. They go by various names: pass-through securities, participation certificates, collateralized mortgage obligations, CMOs, collateralized debt obligations, CDOs, mortgage-backed securities. You see, you make a loan, and you think Mission Federal or Wells Fargo is the actual entity that you're making your payments to. Well, yeah, that's true, but they turned around and sold the loan to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. and they are just the individual entity that is servicing the loan. Your payments are actually going through them to these agencies, who then turn around and pool your mortgage with 1,000 other mortgages and sell those as securities, turn them into bonds. It's a very important process in a modern economy. But remember, nothing is perfect, and these things got caught up in the housing bubble, as did many other financial entities in the 2000s, and they were very hard hit. But for decades, they have been very successful. In fact, they are still successful, folks. They've bounced back, even though they are now owned by you and I, the taxpayers. They're owned by you and me. Yes, the federal government now is the proud owner of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and what to do with these things is a huge political issue. Folks, they're making money for the government. I mean, they're working, but do we really want the government in the business of making home loans? I don't think so, and a lot of other people agree with me, but we can't agree on what to do with them and how to spin them off from the federal government. So it's a real issue. It's a real issue that the politicians don't want to talk about because it's a thorny issue, and they don't know what to do with them. They're so far so good. You know, it's kind of like having it's not a time bomb because they're doing well, but how to separate them is the real issue. I guess it's like they're conjoined twins, Siamese twins, and they don't want to kill them when they spin them off from the government, but at the same time they don't want them part of the government. Do a little bit of education, because it's a real interesting but thorny problem for the government. 28. This process that where we transform lending vehicles such as mortgages into marketable securities is called securitization. And as I said, it's very important, but it's fairly new. You know, it's only been around for 20, 30 years that we've been doing this, 40 years, and it has run into some problems, but it's actually been very successful. There are many success stories. They are called asset-backed securities. Not only mortgage-backed securities, but these asset-backed securities can be backed, by bank loans, leases, credit cards, car loans, patents, stocks. Even artists like David Bowie and REM. David Bowie was the first to do this, and they were called Bowie bonds. It was a small issue by bond standards, but this was back in the 1980s, when David Bowie said, "Look, I'm David Bowie. I'm a very successful artist. I want to borrow $55 million. I'm pretty sure that was the number, $55 million, and I'm going to use it to extend my art, and I'm going to make money and pay off the bonds." And people just raised their eyebrows at first and said, "What is this?" But they sold. People bought them, and they all paid off. I mean, he did very well for himself. Thank you very much. And then the band REM did the same thing. And my understanding is all the bonds were so interesting. All the bonds were paid, so nobody got stuck. You and I can't go to the world and say, "Hey, would you lend us $5 million? We'll pay you back with interest." No, but because they are very popular artists and made a lot of money with their art, they were able to do it. Cool, you like that? Collateralized bond obligations, structured investment vehicles. They go by various names. I think it's pretty interesting, actually. Slide number 29. Okay, so we've left the world of treasuries. Now we're into municipal bonds, state and local governments, munis. These are debt securities issued by states, counties, cities, other political subdivisions, and most all of them are tax exempt. Now, the IRS doesn't want us to use the term tax free. They don't like that term. They like the term tax exempt, which means they're free from federal income taxes. And this is part of the Constitution. The feds can't tax the states can't tax the feds. Oh, by the way, treasuries are exempt from state taxes. You see? Very cool, very cool. If you get any capital gains on your bonds, well, no, that's not tax exempt. And there are some bonds, I don't know how the Congress pulled this one off, but they said, oh, I think it was the IRS said to the Congress, look, these bonds aren't really muni bonds. The entities are municipal, but the benefactor is a private developer who's helping the municipality build something. So we're not going to allow these things to be tax exempt if you, the investor, are subject to the AMT. So I'm not sure exactly how it works out. I'm not a lawyer, but if you're interested, not too many students at Southwestern are hit by the alternative minimum tax, and if you are, do educate yourself. I'm not, so I'm not worried. no, this is only if you invest in muni bonds and you are subject to the alternative minimum tax, you want to make sure that your bond is not exempt from the tax exemption. And if that's confusing, you need to consult somebody else. I apologize. But no, it's not that hard. Just make sure that if you are hit by the AMT, that your bonds are not disqualified from the tax-free, tax-exempt status. Muni bonds are very popular with individual investors, high net worth individual investors, high income, high tax individuals. In fact, when we take a look at the muni bond advertisement, you're going to see it says $25,000 minimum investment. How many people have $25,000 lying around the house, right? Some muni bonds are insured, which is obviously a desirable feature, but you have to know whether or not the insurance company is going to be able to survive a downturn, which in the Great Recession, one of them didn't. So take a look at that. In the face-to-face class now, we trot out a couple of examples, and they're on the website, and they're in Canvas. So take a look at them. So let's take a look on slide 30 to the types of municipal bonds. And again, we're going from the most secure to special tax bonds are a different breed. GOs, general obligation bonds. These are more desirable than revenue bonds. Although some people say, no. If the revenue bond is cool, you want that more than the general obligation bond. But a general obligation bond says, look, we're the state of California, or the state of Utah, or whatever, or we're the city of Chula Vista, or the city of Los Angeles, or we're a school district, or a water, water authority would be revenue bond, but we're an entity that has the ability to tax its taxpayers. And these bonds are backed by the full faith and credit and taxing authority of the issuer. So they must be paid. They must be paid. And if the entity claims bankruptcy, and I don't know if you remember, about 10 years ago, the city of San Diego was saying, if we don't have this fixed, we're going to claim bankruptcy. It was total BS. Because if they did claim bankruptcy, the judge would look at the city of San Diego and say, hey, you have taxing authority, don't you? You can hit your citizens with a higher tax. So it was all BS. Now, revenue bonds are a little different. These are bonds that require the payment of principal and interest only if there's sufficient revenue generated by the issuer. So these are, as we say here, less desirable than general obligation bonds. But in reality, I've heard other individuals who are far more sophisticated when it comes to bonds saying, no, you don't understand. You want to research that project, whatever that project happens to be, and you want to make sure that that project is going to generate the revenue. And then you're cool. So, for example, you're a water authority, and you need to build a water treatment plant, and you're going to be taxing your ratepayers because people need water, right? Or you're a bridge. You want to build a bridge, a bridge authority, and you're going to build a bridge, and you're going to be charging tolls. That's how it works, revenue bonds. And sure, if the bridge turns out nobody uses it and there's no tolls, you're going to be in a world of hurt as the investor, as the bondholder. But normally, people don't build the bridge unless they know there's a tremendous need for it. So these revenue bonds, even though we say that they're less desirable than general obligation bonds, I've heard many investors who are very smart, by the way, a lot smarter than me, say, no, you just make sure you research that revenue, whatever the project is, and you'll find that, no, they pay even better. Now, special tax bonds are a special situation. And they are payable from the proceeds of a special tax. Typically, the issuer goes to the local taxpayers and says, look, you know, we're the Southwestern Community College, and we want to fix up the campus. It's been, you know, around for over 50 years. We want to upgrade the older buildings, and we want to build new buildings. Will you allow us to do it? And the South Bay voters, in the case of Propositions R and Z and the previous one, AA, the South Bay voters said, yeah, we like you, Southwestern College. We will approve this special tax. And so now the bonds that we sold, the money we received from the bonds, is going to be paid back, the interest and the principal, from special property taxes that are levied on the property owners. Now, you get the feeling that people don't really often understand how they're being... Sure, you know, we like Southwestern College, we want them to prosper, but do they really understand that there's going to be a tax on the property for the next 30 years to pay off these bonds? I don't always know that, but I know it, and you know it now, too. So thank you very much, voters of the South Bay, because Southwestern College is your college, and we work hard to be, it sounds like an advertisement. My apologies. Slide number 31. What are the municipal bond tax advantages? Well, as we said, they're free from federal income taxes. Very cool. And what we're going to do in the next chapter, we're going to learn how to compute the taxable equivalent yield. And if you purchase municipal bonds in your state will say, look, we will waive, W-A-I-V-E, the income taxes. So for us in California, if you buy a California muni bond, not only do you not pay federal income taxes, well, that's true of all muni bonds, but you also will not pay California income tax. So these things are extremely popular with higher income bracket individuals. And I thought it was very cute. The governing board, when we were floating these bonds, was saying, you know, we really need to advertise these so that people in the South Bay can take advantage of them and buy them and earn the interest. And I didn't say anything to them because I didn't want to burst a little bubble, but I was joking with a few of the other professors saying they don't understand, you know, people in the South Bay, and maybe some of them do, but most don't buy muni bonds. You know, they're for people in Rancho Santa Fe and Del Mar. Yes, those very exclusive areas where they are in the 35 and 39.6% tax bracket. Yeah, those individuals, they buy muni bonds. Remember, capital gains, if interest rates fall and bond prices rise and you sell your bond at a premium, you still have to pay taxes on the capital gains because that wasn't part of the bargain. That was just you bought it for less, sold it for more. That's the capital gain. Slide 32. So now we're taking a look at corporate bonds. And corporate bonds have a pecking order. They come in secured and unsecured debentures. Secured bonds are like the mortgage-backed bonds we described. They're backed by some claim on a specific property, real estate, airplanes, railroad equipment, plants and equipment. And then, of course, junior lien bonds are secondary, kind of like a second mortgage on your home. So the senior bonds would get paid first, and then the junior bonds would get paid after anything was left over if there was a case of default. Now, unsecured bonds are like the general obligation bonds. They're backed by the full faith and credit of the corporation, which means, hey, you know, if something goes wrong, Yeah, you got to go after whatever's left over in the corporation, whereas the secured bonds are secured by those assets. And then income bonds are not that, my understanding, they're not that prevalent, but they are bonds that require interest payments only if a certain amount of income is earned. And I've never seen any of these things. I assume they exist. I mean, they tell me they exist, and you're supposed to know them for the Series 7, but I've never seen any, so I don't know. Check it out. See if they do exist, or maybe it's just something that we ask you to remember, and everyone forgets about them because they don't exist. Maybe they do. I apologize. I'm being a little silly today. I should really go and find a few and show them to you. Slide number 33, zero coupon bonds. What is going on here? What are these zero coupon bonds? Well, these are bonds with no coupons. Remember, clipping the coupon meant earning interest? Right. Instead of a $1,000 bond costing $1,000, a $1,000 bond might only cost you $300. And instead of you getting 6.25%, the example here on slide 33, you would, in interest every year, the bond's value would increase. We use the word accrue. And if you're used to accounting, you know what the accrual method. So instead of receiving the interest in cash, the bonds grow in value. They accrue in value until the maturity. So for the example we have here, it's a $1,000 bond maturing in 20 years at 6.25%. It would only cost you $300. Remember the savings bonds? You buy them for $25, you get back $50. Yeah. After 10 years, the bond would be worth $550. After 20 years, the bond would be worth $1,000. Now, there's some disadvantages to these. Because there's no interest payments, they're very sensitive to interest rate changes, and they can exhibit wide price swings. But again, if all you intend to do is hold on to it, what do you care? But the IRS says, they expect you to pay taxes on the accrued interest, even though you didn't receive the money in cash. I wish somebody would get the phone. The IRS expects you to pay taxes. Wait a minute, I didn't get any money. Well, the IRS says, hey, your bond went up in value, and that's interest. You have to pay income taxes on that. So what people often do is they put them in an IRA or other retirement tax sheltered account, and then, right, exactly, you don't pay the taxes until you take the money out in retirement. Or they're very popular with municipal bonds, which means, what does that mean? That means you don't pay taxes on the interest because they're muni bonds. So this is very popular with muni bonds and in IRAs. So we are going to ask a few questions when you get to calculations about the zero coupon bonds, because they exhibit very interesting behaviors, very, very interesting. But remember, no interest payments. They simply accrue in value. Slide 34, junk bonds, high yield, high risk, distressed bonds, non-investment grade. Junk is what people use, but the technical term is non-investment grade. These are high risk securities that have low ratings but produce high yields. Distressed, speculative bonds. They are issued by corporations, but there are some muni bonds that are junk status. In the 1980s, junk bonds became an industry, as companies not normally large enough to issue bonds began to issue bonds with very high interest rates. So before the 1980s, these things were considered, you know, just something you just did not do. You know, some speculative investors would invest in them. But then a company called Drexel Burnham Lambert, started issuing them for companies that were very small, and at outrageous interest rates. One of them was Vagabond Inns, Vagabond Hotels, Vagabond Inns, which is actually based here in San Diego. And the gentleman who was in charge was a gentleman by the name of Ivan Boesky. And He was saying, we're going to make Vagabond Inns we're going to make this thing the best hotel, motel chain in the nation, in the world. And he had all these grandiose things he was saying, but it was all BS. He was taking the money and using it to do insider trading. And who was helping him? A gentleman by the name of Michael Milken inside Drexel Burnham Lambert. And you've seen the movie Wall Street, and then they made a remake of it, Gordon Gekko or whatever his name is. That's Michael Milken, right? Exactly. And yes, it crashed and burned, but actually Vagabond Inn survived. They survived the turmoil. Michael Milken and Ivan Boesky both went to jail, and Mr. Milken left jail and with a net worth of about $650 million. I think he spent 18 months in jail. So would you do that? Would you do 18 months in jail for $650 million? I don't know. Anyway, so now you know, junk bonds are not something that we want normally, but there is very high risk, but often the opportunity for large capital gains. Why? Because junk bonds, if the company turns around, right, as Vagabond Inns did, then the bonds will rise in price and they will no longer be junk anymore. So it's why we say, you know, these are the riskiest types of bonds. And we're going to talk about correlation later on in the semester. They are more correlated with stocks. They tend to follow the stock market as opposed to what bonds do. Bonds tend to do the opposite of what the stock market's doing. Not always, but we'll see. We'll talk about that more later. So junk bonds, do you want junk bonds in your portfolio? Maybe a little bit, folks. Maybe 5% or something like that. But normally you want to stay away from these things, in my humble opinion. Now, foreign bonds. Typically, for many years, most investors have stayed away from them because of all the currency issues and the fact that you had to change your dollars into yen or euros or pesos or whatever. Well, many countries said, you know what, we really like the fact that United States investors are very wealthy and like to invest all around the world. We will dollar denominate our bonds. In other words, Argentina said, we'll make these bonds, but instead of paying in whatever they have the Argentine peso, we'll pay in dollars. So American investors said, okay, you know, you're going to pay me in dollars, no problem, I'll do that. So there's no risk of currency fluctuations. But other bonds, there is. If you buy a Mexican bond and you get paid in pesos, you have to change your dollars to pesos, and they pay you in pesos. So now here's the thing about foreign currencies. We've already discussed this a little bit. Let's discuss it again. It's like the interest rates and the bond prices. If the dollar goes down, your value of your bond goes up. If the dollar goes up, the value of your bond goes down. It's that same seesaw. And so you have to worry about that. But over the long stretch of time, the currency issues tend to wash out. But not always. The dollar is very strong now. So if I were searching for investments in the global world, I would love to move my dollars into other currencies because I think the dollar is going to fall over the next few years. But we don't know. We really don't know, folks. I mean, that's the problem. It could strengthen. It's hard to see it getting a lot more strength than it had. It peaked back in January 2017, I remember we got 21.7 or so pesos to the dollar. So, yeah. And I'm thinking, this is a great time to buy a house down in Mexico. You know, this would be because you're using strong dollars to buy weak pesos. And the same thing is true in many currencies around. Not all. But the pound has fallen relative to the dollar. The euro, the yen fell, but then it's come back. So that's what you have to think about. But what do most of us small, I'm not talking about size, I'm talking about money. What do most of us small investors do? We invest via global and international bond funds because the mutual fund managers have the wherewithal to move the dollars back and forth to other currencies. They have global networks, global research organizations, It's just very difficult for us individual investors. So, in general, most of us are just going to stay away from foreign bonds and use bond funds, global and international bond funds. Excellent. So now, let's turn our attention to bond ratings. So we've gone through from the risk, the least riskiest to the riskiest bonds. Let's turn our attention to bond ratings. These are letter grades that designate the investment quality and are assigned to a bond issue by rating agencies. If you've taken Business 121, you learned about the FICO score, credit scores that are available for individuals who want to borrow money. Well, this is the same idea, but it's a little bit more sophisticated in that the rating agencies have to go out and basically rate the issues, the corporations, the municipals, the municipal entities, the state and local governments, the school districts, the water authorities, the bridge authorities. And often what happens is the entity pays Standard & Poor's and Moody's to do the rating. Now, do you see a conflict of interest here? Yeah. For a long time, I didn't trust these. I still don't trust them that much. I like to think of them as the idiot lights on your dashboard. Now I'm not a motorhead. I'm not much about cars. But my understanding is once the red light, the oil light, you know, the engine light goes on, it's too late, folks. It's too late. Just keep driving, you know, your car. No, not anymore. My understanding is now those idiot lights, as they're called, are a lot more sophisticated. And if you see the red light go on, pull over immediately, check your oil. Yeah, exactly. So these are supposedly better, too. They say they're better, right? But let's read at the bottom of slide 36. In the wake of the 2001 to 2002 corporate scandals, the rating agencies were caught completely off guard. They didn't downgrade Enron and WorldCom until they were practically in default. And I don't know if you remember, some of you might be young, but Enron and WorldCom were just two of the companies that were doing financial shenanigans. Definitely unethical and verging, and some of them, on illegal accounting gimmicks and pranks. And then they were again called to task because of the 2008-2009 mortgage-backed bond crisis. Yeah, they screwed up again. They were taking these liar loan documents, these mortgages that were based on people just saying, yeah, I'm making $100,000. They were actually making $30,000 a year. And they were giving them AAA. And we'll talk about that in the next slide. I'm sorry. They were giving them the best rating. Oh, yeah. Oh, it was a terrible scandal. And they almost took down the entire economy. Look, they weren't the only ones. There's a lot of blame to go around, folks. But Standard & Poor's and Moody's were just called on the carpet by the Congress. You guys screwed up royally. And they said, you're right, we did. And then they were accused of basically, as we said, they're paid by the entities that are issuing the bonds. You have a terrible conflict of interest. And they say, we're shocked. We're shocked that you would accuse us of such a, obviously, blatantly conflict of interest. Whatever. Nothing's perfect. Nothing's perfect. Slide 37. Here it is. Here's the rating. I think it's kind of silly, actually, but other people love it. AAA, AAA, Triple B. So those are the investment grade. And there's very few entities that are AAA. You know, the federal government used to be AAA for decades, and then they lowered them in 2011. Big mistake. Look, folks, the federal government, I don't care what anybody says. I don't care what radio station you listen to or what website you go to. The federal government will pay its debts, folks. We've got plenty of taxing authority. We have tremendous, our economy is very strong. It's not as strong as it used to be, and it's getting better. I mean, we're still recovering from we've recovered quite substantially, but it remains to be seen whether we can get interest rates back to where they were. But the federal government's not going to go bankrupt, folks. It just isn't going to do it. But anyway, they lowered it anyway. Not because of the ability to pay, because of the politics back in 2011 when the Congress wasn't playing nice with the president. It was a sad time. And then that's where Southwestern is, by the way. We're double A. And then medium grade is triple B. And that's the last investment grade. Anything below triple B, double B, B, triple C, CC, double, you know, single C, default, that means D for default, no F. That's junk, speculative, distressed, poor quality. It's non-investment grade. So anything triple B or above is investment grade. Anything below triple B, BB down to C, is junk, is non-investment grade. And I want you to take a look. Now it's when we would look at the Ford bonds, and you'd see what happened with Ford. It was brought down low to triple C and then worked its way back up to triple B. So it's very interesting what happened during the, not only interesting, it was very darn right scary what happened during the Great Recession. Okay, so then on slide 38, what they do is they add a plus sign or a minus sign. And that's what S&P does. As Southwestern is double A minus. And the previous, actually I think it was two financial officers, or vice president in charge of financial affairs, he did his best like 3 ago. He was a 3 ago. He wanted us to get back up to get up to double A. He wanted to get the minus taken off. And he was a big jerk. But anyway, he was trying his best, he thought, for Wall Street, not for Southwestern. He wasn't worried about Southwestern. He was worried about Wall Street. And then Moody's might add a 1, 2, or 3, meaning, you know, 1's better, 2's 3. But I like to, this S&P is a little bit easier to understand, plus or minus. So it's kind of silly, don't you think? I mean, what's the difference between AAA, AAA, triple B, double B, B? I don't, it reminds me of eggs. You know, what's the difference between a grade A egg and a grade BB egg? I don't know. They all taste the same to me. I guess I've never tried a triple C egg. If you try them, and tell me what they taste like. Slide 39. My apologies. Bond trading. Well, it turns out, folks, that you and I are not the people that bond traders are interested in. Right? We don't have tens of thousands of dollars, as you'll see when you take a look at the advertisement, $25,000 minimum investment. Trading volume is often thin. Why? Because as we said in the previous, presentation, people hang on to their bonds. They buy their bonds for income, and they just put them away and collect the interest. And so you can find a hard time buying them. Hey, I want these bonds. Hey, none of them are for sale. And if you do transactions under $10,000, you're not going to be treated well. It's like, go away. We don't want you. We want $25,000 minimum. In fact, they normally deal in hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars. Do you remember John Merriweather from Chapter 1? Right. He was a bond trader. Right. So, yeah. How are most of us going to buy our bonds, folks? Right. Through mutual funds. But now there are exceptions, folks. There's an exception. If you want to buy treasury bonds, notes, those tips, treasury bills, as we saw in Chapter 1, the treasurydirect.gov website allows us to get the same exact prices, folks, as the folks on Wall Street. So you come up with $1,000, you go to a bond trader and say, I'd like to buy one bond. Get out of here. If you press, they'll say, okay, we'll sell it to you, but you're going to pay us a lot more than what the bond is worth. And then when you try to sell it back to them, they go, oh, we're not going to give you what it's worth. Whereas this Treasury says, no. You can buy that $1,000 bond, just one if you want, and we'll give you the same price we give to people who buy millions of dollars of bonds. So cool, very cool. When the government does something good, we want to say good things about them. Because we sure do like to complain when they screw up, and oh boy, do they screw up. Okay, slide number 40, bond quotes. Well, it turns out that getting bond quotes is a little harder, it's a lot harder than getting stock quotes. And why is this? Well, folks, as we said, bond investors are normally extremely wealthy, so they have their own personal brokers. Bonds are normally quoted as a percentage of par. huh? What does that mean? Well, instead of giving you the price, what they do is they put the percentage, 97.25. Well, that means 97.25% of the par value, and since, again, in our class, for our purposes, par value will always be 1,000, then one bar bond would be 97.25% times 1,000, or $972.50. So just move the decimal place one to the right. Just move, just take that decimal place here and boop, move it one to the right. And that's all you have to do. So $972.50, right? That's a discount bond because it originally sold for $1,000. Indeed. So we're going to learn about all about that. We're going to see, you're going to see some presentations. Go on the website or through Canvas. You're going to see some bond quotes that we did for Ford and Poway. And then you're going to do some. You're going to go out and find some bond quotes as part of your Chapter 9 assignment. The Yahoo website used to be pretty darn good for bonds. That's what I used for years, but now it's completely destroyed. And so FINRA, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, is a place where you can still get bond quotes. And some of them are not very good. And folks, I don't even think it's FINRA. I think it's Morningstar, right? Because you'll see when you take a look at the URL, the website itself. But you go to Morningstar's website, and you can't find bond quotes. I guess that's part of the premium. I don't know. I'm confused. I'm not a big... I'll tell you right off the bat. Oh, no, I did. I should have told you at the beginning. I don't really like bonds. They're not my favorite investment, especially now with interest rates so low. Once a person is thoroughly immersed with the idea that stocks are going to be volatile, folks, but if you have a long-term perspective, they're the best investment, financial, over time. You know, the real estate people will scream and holler at me and say, oh, real estate's better. Well, that's a different world. But as long as you learn the emotional part as well as the intellectual part, learn that downturns in the stock market are not something where you should just run for the hills. That's the worst thing to do. You should just relax and keep putting more money in every month, $50, $100 more if you can afford it. Because, as we've said before, if the whole thing falls apart, folks, literally, if the whole financial system comes crashing down, the economy crashes, and we have 25%, 30% unemployment, and there's no food at the Vons, and there's no gas at the Chevron station, now we have 40, 50% unemployment, and the people are driving around with the guns, and the hospitals are shuttered, and the banks are shuttered, and the police departments and the fire departments, and there's no water and the trash isn't being picked up, your stock portfolio, your bond portfolio is going to be the last thing you're worried about, right? Now, of course, when you get older, bonds are important, folks. I mean, you need that stability. So that's why we talked glowingly about balance funds back in Chapter 4. But I'm not a big sports fan. I think I've told you that before. But to me, bonds represent football. It's fixed. It's played on a rectangle. You can't go out of bounds. If you go out of bounds, you're out of the game. Right? Well, at least for that. Not for the whole game. But you're out of that play. Whereas stocks represent baseball. And the baseball is a diamond, and the foul lines go off into infinity. Well, not really. I mean, you can't hit a ball into infinity, but it's open-ended. You see, the stocks are not fixed. If the economy does well, if people get jobs, if new inventions are built and our better life, we have a higher standard of living, and people all around the world have access to clean water and good food and clothing and shelter and internet access. Of course, they have to have internet access. And bicycles and cars and cell phones and toothpaste and all the things that we take for granted. No, the goalposts, forget it. We've long passed the goalposts. We've flown. We've gone way out into the bleachers and then even farther out. Make sense? I don't know if it makes sense. But that's what I like to think about. I'm optimistic. Because the alternative is just failure is not an option, folks. You know, nobody wins a nuclear war. Nobody. I don't care how many nukes you have. It doesn't take that many. So assuming we don't blow ourselves up, die in our own waste, a tsunami of gigantic proportions, a meteorite, Ebola, assuming that things don't happen, I'm really optimistic over the next 10, 20, 30 years. We're going to cure cancer, if you can believe that. And so stocks are the place to be. But that doesn't mean you still don't learn about bonds. And once you get older, and I'm thinking, folks, in my humble opinion, now you're going to get other opinions. I'm just going off. I apologize. You can stop here if you want. But if you're in your 20s, 30s, even 40s, stay away from bonds, assuming you don't panic when the market falls. Once you get into your 50s, okay, start buying some bonds, maybe some global and domestic balance funds, right? At my age, I should have a whole lot more bonds. I don't. I have some, and I'm buying right now. Our new investments my wife and I are making are into a global balance fund, so we're buying some bonds. But I'm still heavily invested in stocks, and I'm hoping I still have, I won't tell you how old I am. I'm old. people are living far longer. So come back in 10, 20 years if I'm still around. We'll see if it worked out for me, okay? And I hope it works out for you. That is our introduction to bonds. And in our next presentation, we will discuss the calculations that are associated with bonds and how to value bonds. And it turns out it's a whole lot easier than valuing stocks. See you in Chapter 10, Bond Prices, Valuation, and Yield.